It's about 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today. I want to remind you it's National Trail Day. Saturday's hike for June 7th is going to be the Salmon Creek Dam Trail. They want you to wear warm layers of clothing and bring plenty of food and water and meet at the trailhead. Now, this is that trailhead that's up behind Alaska Light and Electric Light and Power's company powerhouse. This is 2.5 miles north of Juneau. It's off of Egan Drive, but you can only get to it if you're on the northbound lanes because it's just there's no road that goes across. So you have to, if you need to, you need to come in to, I guess, almost to town before you make a U-turn and then come back down on the north side. Anyway, 9:30 in the morning is the gathering time, and they've asked for no dogs or firearms, please. So it's National Trail Day up to Salmon Creek Dam, so take advantage of that if you want to tomorrow. And speaking of tomorrow, by the way, we're probably going to be hiking in the rain, so be sure you bring a raincoat. The forecast is for increasing clouds tonight, and probably the rain is going to probably come to us late tonight with maybe a chance of rain in the morning, and then it just says in the forecast rain in the afternoon. So they're not pulling any punches here. It's going to rain for the next 3 or 4 days. But let's see, what is it? Wednesday through Thursday, they're saying mostly cloudy with highs up around 60 and the lows 44 to 50. So we're looking at maybe clearing off or at least clouds without rain near the middle of the week. My first guest on the show today just took me through his very impressive collection of photographs here that are all over the walls at KTOO. It's First Friday, and Wayne Owens has brought his collection of Wayne Owen, I guess. There's only one of you, right?
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Anyway, Wayne has a really interesting collection of photos because they are not they're not portraiture. They're not animals caught in things. They're really very ordinary objects. There's a picket fence, and there's a tree against a wall, and like that. But all the way through the theme, there's this, or all the way through the show, there's this kind of theme of emergence. One of the things that I know Wayne does, and he's conscious of it as well, is that he takes pictures of plants coming through cracks in concrete and growing out of brick walls and things like that. So there's a sense of maybe wonder in the persistence of nature, perhaps. Is that what I'm seeing here?
Absolutely. We in Alaska are really blessed with the amount of nature that it's around us, and not that people take it for granted, but it's abundant. And in a lot of places where I've lived in the past, there's a scarcity of nature, and I've lived in those places, and it's sort of nice to be able to take a moment and stop and recognize that everywhere you go, there's something alive trying to happen. And whether that's little plants breaking apart the concrete, growing out of walls, moss on things, it sort of warms the heart to know that in the long run, Mother Nature wins, and we should all recognize that. It's not an excuse to make a mess of things now, but in the long run,
and
Mother Nature wins.
She is not to be messed with.
She is not to be messed with.
Now, probably one of the most interesting images in your collection out there is as you hit the top of the KTOO stairs, you are suddenly presented with repeated views of Thunder Mountain.
Oh, Thunder Mountain's a beautiful place.
Yeah, it is, and it's really interesting that you've captured so many different moods of it. Because you live at the base.
Base of Thunder Mountain, out in the valley.
And you got a little groove track out there that you walk when you take these, right?
We were talking earlier, there is a specific place in my driveway that I stand, and just whenever the mountain looks pretty, I pull the camera out and take a picture, and I have a file of hundreds of these now for the years that I've lived there. And who knows what I'll do with them.
Well, you have to make another canvas now when the mountain looks ugly. I mean,
maybe a video installation of just picture after picture after picture.
I'm told that there are avalanches on Thunder Mountain. It's a vertical rock face, so you must. Have you ever caught one? Have you ever run out there in time to catch one breaking loose?
Not photographically, but hear them all the time.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. You get the right conditions, you sort of know when they're going to happen. And the mountain is aptly named Thunder Mountain because it sounds like that distant roll of thunder. And it's kind of nice to know that. Well, again, there's that theme. There's an active nature, an active earth, and stand back.
Now, you're one of the rare lucky people whose occupation overlaps this interest. You get to do it both during the day and during the evening. Because I think you're the director of the Wildlife, Fisheries, Ecology, Watershed, and Subsistence Program.
Yeah, I have position in the Forest Service.
Uh-huh.
Although the work that we're seeing here, there's no Forest Service. You know, a lot of this stuff is urban, you know, and you know, so they're not overlapping in any way. I think that's I came to this before I came to the Forest Service. This is, you know, I grew up in a rural place, and throughout my life, you know, living in cities, in the military, traveling around the world, literally, and always appreciating the natural world and the different places that I've lived and worked. That has stuck with me throughout my life. And it's nice to be able to have that special eye out for these little details and caught that along, I think.
When did you start? I think everyone tries to take pictures when they first get a camera. They try to take pictures of important things. That was my, you know, I wanted
sure.
pictures of this building because it was someone had told me that it had historic significance or something. When did you start taking ordinary pictures? When did you move over into this world where your pictures are the pictures of ordinary things seen maybe slightly differently? Was that a conscious transition?
You know, I think, Pat, it was an outgrowth of, you know, my post-military life. You know, at the time, military, you know, I started taking cameras in the early 70s when I was overseas and could buy a camera and needed a hobby. And you were taking pictures of mountains and airplanes and buildings and just like mm-hmm. you say. And I got out and started going to school, took biology classes, went to graduate school to get my PhD in ecology. And through that, you acquire an education for observation, and you start noticing things. You know, if your brain is set up right, you start noticing details a lot. And there's a lot of fascination in small detail, and there's a lot of stories to be imagined or told in small details. And I think that was sort of the gist of that, having one's mind opened up to those small details and then wanting to capture those images or those vignettes or those scenes.
Do you get ideas from other photographers? Do you look at other people's
certainly.
Work?
Certainly. Oh, all the time.
Anybody
Absolutely.
In particular?
Well, maybe not so much for the content,
mm-hmm.
but there are certainly photographers that I admire quite a bit. You know, a local favorite, people around here know my friend Amy Gulick, mm-hmm. who is she's spoken on this program before. But maybe somebody, more art photography like a Sally Mann, who captures everyday scenes, very high contrasty sort of images that are very evocative, and you wonder what exactly is going on there. That, and I really like a lot of sort of urban street photographers that are capturing people. Again, there are situations where you ask the question, what's really going on here, and what are these people interacting with, or what are they doing? So I think those photos that ask questions that have potential in them.
You also move away from photography, and you've done a lot of work in acrylics and cut wood
right.
as well. Yeah, so those two are kind of like visual extensions of the same kind of process, but stuff you can't take a picture of.
Stuff you can't take a picture of. Again, it's trying to imagine, trying to look at different ways to see things and different ways to talk about. I sometimes tell people around me, especially scientists, other scientists who are very much interested in the truth. You know, I try to, you know, when it's opportune, not pedantically, but to remind people that there's often more than one truth. There's often more than one way to look at something. And so that stirs around in my mind. And so the painting that is here today and mm-hmm. the stuff that I have at home that, you know, that I've not brought in are all along that theme about what's another way to look at this.
Okay. Wayne Owen, his stuff is going to be all over the walls of K2. You're leaving the thing up for a few days after the...
Yeah, I think it's up all month.
Up all month. Okay, so, but today you have this unique advantage that Wayne will be here to kind of walk you through his show, and we have a reception going on before 4:30 to 6:30
for
nice
Friday. There's nice snacks,
so.
Yeah?
Yeah, so come on by. Take a look at this stuff. It's the kind of thing where you want to stand in front of them for a little while and kind of take a look at the detail, because there's some really interesting images and ideas here. So, thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. What a comfort it would be to legions of birders if every bird song were as easy to recognize and remember as that of the olive-sided flycatcher. Take a walk in the mountains of the north or west in summer, and you're likely to hear the olive-sided flycatcher's blithely whistled three-note song. Bird ID guides have tried to capture its pattern and quality with such catchphrases as "quick three beers" or "what peeves you?" The bird's behavior also makes it easy to get to know. It perches conspicuously, bolt upright, high in the tops of dead trees. Then it sallies out to snatch flying insects. The olive-sided flycatcher is gray, with a peaked crown and dark vest, and it stands about 8 inches tall. And though it favors the edges of mountain forests, this migratory flycatcher also nests in small numbers in green belts and parks. It was once a common breeder in western forests, but the bird's numbers have declined in recent decades. The reasons are unclear, but loss of trees where it winters, some 4,000 miles away in South America, may be a leading cause. Do you drink coffee? You can help olive-sided flycatchers when you choose to drink shade-grown coffee. It encourages coffee growers to keep the trees that make the shade. Learn where to purchase shade coffee on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
It's 18 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is going to be putting on a show at Canvas from 4:30 to 7. And I believe this is part of there's a fellowship or a scholarship that took you to Tracy Arm to take these photographs. Is that right? Or do the work?
Yeah, it actually...
I should tell you, this is Kevin Hood, U.S. Forest Service guy who's also an artist in his own right. Well,
I'd like to think so. My official title in this exercise is actually going to be Wilderness Manager. And so what we have going on is a program called Voices of the Wilderness.
Yeah, and this is artists spending time in the wilderness under sponsorship.
Exactly. And as this 2014 is the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, which was passed back in 1964, mm-hmm. Part of what we're doing is celebrating it by having a traveling exhibit with quite a few art pieces from artists who've spent residencies in Alaskan wilderness areas. The whole show has pieces from 20 different wilderness areas in Alaska, and it's a variety of media that are on display. And so the show has started in Sitka, went down to Ketchikan, and now for the month of June it will be on display at the Canvas, mm-hmm. and we'll have the grand opening tonight for First Friday there. And it's free and open to the public, and we heartily encourage everyone to go down there and take a look at some of the amazing pieces of work that have been inspired by Alaskan wilderness.
Now, Solon Jensen is one of the artists who's going to be featured in this.
He's actually one of
his role.
He's one of the wilderness rangers who's taken people out there. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sorry, we didn't get all the information out. It's been a scramble to put up all these pieces, and we've been running around like crazy. The artists, it's a wide variety of artists. Some are from Alaska, some are from elsewhere in the lower 48, And the pieces that will be on display, we weren't able to get every single piece of art up that for the show just due to the limited space, but we may cycle in every piece over the course of June. But there'll be photographs on display. There'll be paintings. Some will be like acrylic. Some are oil paintings. There's watercolors. There's some sort of collages made with fabric, kind of like quilts that have various textiles in it, and also even incorporate animal fur, such as ground squirrel, arctic hare, wolf fur into the. There's acoustic recordings.
Soundscape.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and so it's quite a wide variety.
How long does the artist actually have under your assistance or guidance in the wilderness area? This all takes place in where? Tracy Arm, up Tracy Arm, and in the where's the actual area that they work in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Voices of the Wilderness originally started in the Tracy Arm Forge Terre Wilderness area, which lies between Juneau and Petersburg, and the artists would submit. They have an application. We have an application form. And they'd submit an application, we'd select an artist, and then they'd go out with the Wilderness Rangers on sort of a regular stint, which would be about 9 days going out in the field. And it's a little different because the traditional artist residency has an artist sort of just set up it at a cabin or a tent site in the wilderness, and they're left alone. With this Voices of the Wilderness residency, the artists actually engage with the Wilderness Rangers and participate in much of the stewardship projects going on.
I see.
So it could be research, could be monitoring, inventorying, conducting educational activities with visitors, things like that. And so the artists are actually almost participating like a volunteer ranger. And then they're also given time to practice their craft as well.
Mm-hmm. And you've taken people out on this yourself.
I have. Not as much as, say, Solon, who will be there tonight and can share some of his experiences with others, but I have, yeah.
So this is your career, is the stewardship of the wild. My question is, when you have an artist with you, do you see things differently? Do you see insights? Do you get insights from the different view that they may have of the thing?
You do, actually. That's a very good question, because you don't realize how locked into your own frame of mind you are until you go out with someone who's really intent on their own craft. And so I've gone out with photographers, and it was pouring down rain, and they spent about 2 hours photographing a white mushroom against a gigantic Sitka spruce. And I don't even know if I would have seen the mushroom, frankly. I mean, I try to notice everything I can. And sometimes there's certain sounds where I'm used to them, you know, whether it's a waterfall or a bird or maybe a seal. But they'll be, hey, what was that noise? And it kind of brings you back into a heightened awareness of everything around you.
Things renews your awareness maybe as much as anything else.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I hope.
You knew these things earlier.
Yeah, but you've been doing it long enough. You can get used to almost anything.
Yeah.
It's our amazing adaptability, I suppose. And so the hope is that, you know, because wilderness is an area that it's for the enjoyment of all people, whether or not they actually get out there or not, what we're hoping is to be able to provide enjoyment of the wilderness here in town at the canvas. And so hopefully some of the inspiration and some of the deeper meanings of wilderness will be purveyed by the works of art there.
So, Kevin, this show is, there's a reception today from 4:30 to 7 p.m. How long will it be up on the walls? Are they up for a period of time?
Yeah, right now we're looking at June 27th as the rough date. We're not 100% sure because we got to line up with shipping it on, because all these pieces are actually in giant crates, and then we got to get them on to the, I can't remember if it goes to Gustavus from here, I believe, but we'll have to line up.
How many communities actually get the show?
It's going to be about 7 or 8 communities. I know it'll go to Gustavus. It'll also go on to the Kenai Peninsula, where I've heard it'll actually, the whole exhibit will split in two, with I think some going maybe to, I can't remember, is it Soldotna and Homer perhaps?
Probably.
And then also up to Fairbanks. And then it's actually going to end up in Anchorage and be on display downtown at the museum there.
This is fascinating work, and I particularly am interested in that kind of back and forth awareness. I think you probably inspire the artist, and the artist obviously inspires you. And I think that's a wonderful piece of vibration between the two ways of seeing the world that comes out of this.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, often when we're taking the artists out there, we're thinking it'll be mostly between the artist and the wilderness. Mm-hmm. But as they're working with the wilderness rangers, or, you know, as I've been out with a few too, they're often really impressed with just the little, all the efforts we're trying to make. Because being a wilderness ranger, one of the common questions you get is like, well, what do you do, or what's the purpose of your job? And people don't really understand that. And to understand it, you kind of have to understand the role of wilderness in our society. And it's one of it's the highest level of protection we afford any land. And the Wilderness Act notes that, you know, this is an area where we're actually going to check our tendency to modify and occupy all landscapes. What we're going to try to do is preserve some remnant wildness. And in order to do that, you know, Mother Nature generally takes care of the wild part. We don't need to do anything to enhance that. But what we try to do is basically check the human influences, you know, the things that might sort of adulterate that wildness. And so you're looking at trying to monitor, say, air quality. And then if you find that there's pollution coming in, you know, what is it, a local source? Is it something that can be mitigated? You look at invasive weeds. Where are they taking root? And is it actually starting to disrupt the natural balance of things? You know, do we need to go in and do an eradication effort, or do we just simply monitor for now, and maybe the natural vegetation will actually hold its own against these, you know, foreign invaders? You look at things, you know, just common things like trash as well. A lot of, you know, trash can wash up over the course of a year on the beaches, so we patrol the shorelines, try to get rid of all the trash. And but another part of it, it's not just checking the impacts, but it's also telling people about the role of wilderness, especially in modern times. You know, if you happen to go online or look at the news, most environmental news is rather bleak. You know, there's not a lot of positive things coming out. But I think wilderness really gives us some great news. You know, it shows that we have the ability to exercise restraint. Where we do, it's amazing how biodiversity can be preserved, you know, how ecosystem services, like, for example, the filtration of water, you know, through going through different kinds of wetland areas or forests, and then it can serve as our drinking water. You know, we don't have to pay any. The only thing we have to do is, you know, basically not go in there and, you know, ruin the landscape. And so there's a lot of real positive aspects to wilderness and tremendous potential, I think, for both Mother Nature, but also what humans can achieve when they set their minds to it.
Kevin, I think you really like your job, and I think you've done a good job with bringing us Voices of the Wilderness. This is going to be a really interesting part of First Friday today. The reception is 4:30 to 7. This is at the Canvas over on Seward Street. And drop by. You got a little walk around town for First Friday. This would be a good show to kind of add to the route.
Thanks much. I appreciate it. And I'll give some brief opening remarks around 6 p.m. if people are interested. Otherwise, I hope to see them there.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Pat.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 6th of June, 2014. It was on this day, 1933, the first drive-in movie theater opened. It was in Camden, New Jersey, the brainchild of a young man named Richard Hollingshead, Jr. He was managing his father's auto shop in Camden called Wiz Auto Products. And he dreamed of creating something to bring a little fun to life in the Depression. He mounted a film projector on the hood of his car in his backyard and attached a screen to a couple of trees, worked out a system of parking spaces with various ramps and blocks to make sure that every car would have a view of the screen. The sound came from a speaker mounted by the screen. He applied for a patent. He opened his theater on Crescent Boulevard in Camden. The film was a comedy called Wife Beware, starring Adolphe Manjou. It cost 25 cents per car, 25 cents per person after that. There was a kids' play area. There was a snack stand. You could smoke. You could bring your own refreshments. And it felt luxurious, an ordinary motor car transformed into a private theater box. It's the birthday of the man who said, a writer is someone for whom writing is more difficult than it is for other people. Thomas Mann, born in Lübeck, Germany, 1875, author of Buddenbrooks, Mario and the Magician, Dr. Faustus. It's the birthday of Pushkin, Alexander Pushkin, born Moscow, 1799, died at the age of 38, but in his brief life worked in nearly every literary form. His masterpiece was the verse novel Eugene Onegin, about a man who kills his friend in a duel. Pushkin died in a duel. He was married to Natalia Goncharova, the most beautiful woman in Russia. She had many admirers, and one of her suitors was so persistent that Pushkin finally challenged him to a duel and died of his wounds 2 days later. It was on this date, 1889, the Great Seattle Fire destroyed downtown Seattle, started in the basement of a cabinet shop on the corner of Front and Madison. A pot of glue was sitting on top of a stove. The glue caught fire. Over 18 hours, the blaze wiped out the downtown district and the waterfront. And a year later, Seattle had nearly been rebuilt. All the construction jobs sparked a population boom, and it grew from a town of 25,000 into a city of 40,000. Here's a poem for today by Kevin McCaffrey, entitled No Problem. The problem is there is no problem, and the problem solvers have nothing to do, so they start creating problems out of thin air, out of nothing. Then the problem is not to see that there are big problems everywhere, and it is woe unto him or her who cannot see or who will not acknowledge the problems. They become part of the problem, a big part of it. Their apathy or obstinacy, holding progress back until they are educated to the fact that, one, there are big problems, and two, if you are not part of solving them, then you represent the problem the problem solvers have been talking about all along. So you see now how it is. There is no problem worse than no problem. No Problem, a poem by Kevin McCaffrey from his collection Laughing Cult, published by Four Winds Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org, and by lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that's been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Hi, this is Heather Bryant, webmaster here at K2. Each month we construct an online First Friday art guide with pictures and descriptions of gallery openings and events. We've gotten positive feedback on the guide and enjoy providing this service to our listeners and web users. If you're an artist or business owner, please send your picture and brief description to arts@ktoo.org. And don't forget to use the guide as you make your First Friday plans.
It's just coming up on 25 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is working in rock. I guess he's a stone sculptor. Bob Kenitzer is doing a show tonight. He's going to be at the Juneau Artist Gallery from 4:30 to 7:30 with his work. So another good stop to make along the way around the area. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thanks, Pat.
So you started out carving wood, and then transitioned when you were living down in Prince of Wales to working in stone.
I did. I lived in Ketchikan for 25 years, well, in the vicinity of Ketchikan for 25 years, and took lots of classes at the Totem Heritage Center in Ketchikan. And then I was working at Waterfall Resort, which is on the west coast of Prince of Wales Island, remote. Met a guy in Craig who was gathering stone and sculpting, and he taught me the basics of using the tools and gluing and how to deal with issues related to local stone, and I kind of caught fire on that and gradually stopped carving Northwest Coast items and pretty much just do stone now.
So, Bob, when you say the tools, what does it take to carve stone?
I mean, people probably think classically of the hammer and chisel, you know, Michelangelo.
Uh-huh.
Pretty much that's not useful for stone from Southeast Alaska because it has cracks in it. It's especially stuff, marble and limestone are relatively soft in the world of stone. And then the soil tends to be a little acidy here, so you get some wear on the stone from that. And then just tectonic plate movements and the way the stone is formed. There's lots of cracks and lots of healed cracks in the stone, and at the very surface there's fractures. So you have to glue a lot. So using a hammer and chisel, the piece would just come apart on you. So we use grinders and hand tools that aren't as impactful. I don't know if people know what an angle grinder is. And then we use, I have a thing called a die grinder, which is basically a large Dremel tool. And it has big grinding bits on the end. I'll have a sample of tools at the gallery tonight so mm-hmm. I can show people what they are. And then I also use hand pads with diamonds in them. They're basically like the shape of a bar of soap. And they have diamonds embedded in them all the way from 60 grit up to about 3,500 grit. We use files, riffles, which are kind of shaped files. We use just strips of kind of plastic that have diamonds embedded in them. I also have a water system that's kind of like a big bench grinder, but one side has a rubber wheel with emery belts of varying degrees, mm-hmm. and the other side has a wheel that grinds or a blade that'll cut. You know, you can use that for smaller things around the size of soap dishes up to, you know, the size of a paper plate.
Now, you have a lot of rock in your yard.
Right? I do.
Okay. You said how many tons?
I can never move. About 14 tons
about
or so.
14 tons of rock.
Marble
in your
and
okay.
growing.
You married?
My wife hates rocks. I have, yes, we can never.
Artist hazard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you go out in your yard and you're walking around and you see a rock. Do you how close are you when you're looking at that rock to what's eventually going to happen?
That varies. I mean, one thing, you know, some rocks we've collected under permit, so I didn't have to actually pay for it. Other stuff, some really the higher quality things, I pay up to $10 a pound for stone that's cut in a superior quality. So if I have a flat slab, say a 2-inch thick piece that's, you know, the size of a turkey platter. Mm-hmm. I kind of know the shape, and it's, you know, I have some limitations on what I can do, but if I just have a rock that I found that's, say, the size of a basketball, you know, there's always fractures in different planes, and you certainly want to use all the stone. I mean, I don't start with a basketball size shape and end up with a softball shape. It just doesn't make sense to do that. So mm-hmm. I try to utilize as much stone as there. And again, you need to cut around fractures sometimes, and there's a lot of gluing that goes along with it. And, yeah, I mean, I rarely do I have a concept in mind when I pick up a piece. I kind of pick it up and start drawing with a water marker on it to see what's going to stay just because of the way the rock is from fractures, and then it kind of just develops, you know, as it goes. I'm not a figurative artist. I can't draw an arm to save my life. I've carved a lot of masks, both in wood and a few in stone, so I can do faces pretty well, but I mostly do vessels, either platters or, you know, soap dishes, kind of soup bowl size, all the way up to garden basins. For whatever reason, those shapes are appealing to me, and my most recent shapes are more V-shaped, where it's hard, I can't get a tool down there, an electric grinder, so I end up doing a lot of the work by hand, which takes a lot of time. But yeah, I like leaving the shapes fluted along the edges. You'll see some of the shapes I have in the show tonight are really flowing along the edges.
How much do you zone out when you're working on the rock?
At times, a lot, actually. It's just, you know, it's like a hobby. You kind of get in that zone and you just keep working. And you're like, wow, it's 7 o'clock at night already. Uh-huh. And, you know, haven't gone to the bathroom for 4 hours, which is a good thing. Everybody needs those kinds of hobbies.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Have a pretty hectic-paced life. So actually doing the work is is pretty fun. And it's, you know, physically demanding. The rocks are heavy and the grinders and, you know, you smash your fingers and it takes a lot of effort polishing stone. I think that the picture of the stone mask that was in the paper today, I spent literally over 30 hours polishing that by hand, fingers bleeding, you know, takes several weeks. So it takes a lot of effort to get the stone down and
Have you ever had to fight with a stone in order to get it to be what you wanted?
Oh, yeah. Especially, the really good rock. One of the best stones that I use is called Aphrodite Marble that comes from Texarkana Island. It's just absolutely gorgeous stone. And it tends to have fractures, some of the boulders more than others. And only happened one piece. After the third break, it didn't come back after I threw it against the wall. That was the only time. That was a $150 piece of stone.
Yeah.
But
you have those moments when...
You know, when things
you look at
like,
it, you say, this isn't going to work.
Yeah, you're down and the piece is almost done and a chunk of the corner of the rim will break off.
Yeah.
And once a piece comes out, to try and repair it is very difficult. You can never get it back to where it's 100% perfect and it's a challenge. So, yeah, that's one of the other things is in addition to... You know, getting better as from a talent side or from the shapes. Over the years, you learn how to deal with those kinds of things ahead of time to minimize accidents.
And I can see if the rock costs $150, you would want to minimize accidents.
Yeah,
yeah. So, do you beat yourself up when you do that?
Yeah.
No,
I mean, I swear a little bit.
Pick up the ball and go back.
No, it's not. Yeah, no. I'm not that emotionally. I mean, it's just the stone. The stuff is just gorgeous. I mean, I love the stone. That's why I do it. I mean, I'm passionate and I want to see. It's, you know, I think I mentioned it's like an Easter egg hunt finding the stuff, and then you want to see what's inside of there. And then you're like, wow, you know, where did all that stuff come from? It's just so beautiful when you polish the stone, and so it's always exciting to see the finished pieces. But you know, it's disappointing, I'd say, or disheartening when you have a break or a chip come out of a piece. But I've been able to, I get to the point where I can pretty well minimize that.
Mm-hmm.
The hard part is you have to stop pushing. So I'll have five or six pieces going at a time, and you want to just keep pushing a piece to get it finished. But when you push beyond where you know you shouldn't, that's when it breaks.
Yep.
So you have to back off and
go
glue
do something
and let
else.
It sit for a
yeah.
while and settle
yeah.
in. So
yeah.
I've gotten much more patient at that.
Yeah, good. Bob Kanitzer, he's a stone sculptor. It sounds like he's really growing in his art. You get a chance to look at it today and listen to him show you a little around through the thing with his tools and everything else. It's 4:30 to 7:30. It's at the Juno Artists Gallery down Franklin Street.
In the Senate building.
In the Senate building. Good place to go look around. Let's see, how many artists do you have in the...
I think we're up. We just picked up several new artists. I think we're up to 18 or 19 now.
Yeah, so there's 18 artists, and the way the thing works, it's every day you can go in there, and there's always has to be an artist on duty. That's part of the reason it's a co-op. So
we all take turns working shifts, and we're all locals.
But tonight, Bob will be there for sure with a special kind of show that is a real opportunity to get an insight into his art. Thank you, Bob, very much for coming on, for telling us all this stuff.
Thanks, Pat.
A winter's day in a deep and dark December. I am alone, gazing from my window to the streets below on a freshly fallen silent shroud of snow. I am a rock, I am an walls, a fortress deep and mighty that none may penetrate. I have no need of friendship. Friendship causes pain. Its laughter and its loving I disdain. I am a rock. I am an rock. Talk of love, well, I've heard the word before. It's sleeping in my memory.
disturb the slumber of feelings that have died. If I never loved, I never would have cried. I am a rock.
Simon and Garfunkel, of course, I Am a Rock. Bob Kanitzer will be with his rocks tonight over at the Juno Artist Gallery. He's doing a show on his stone sculpture. So that's part of the art walk. And another part of the art walk is this great thing that's going on now, finally, fully back, I guess, over at JACC. And that is Food Truck Friday. This is where we line up all of the ways you can get a fine meal outside the Jack, and then inside the Jack we have entertainment. And tonight the entertainment is Thunder Mountain Big Band, and Tom Myers here. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Pat.
And also, the other thing that the Jack is doing as far as music goes is we've restarted the series of Music on the Fly, which is someone out at the airport startling passengers as they're waiting for TSA by standing over in the corner and playing an instrument, which has got to be a big shock to them at the airport, I'm sure. Anyway, and Kristen Garreau is here. She's going to be taking her violin, I think, to the airport and serenading the folks. So, you said you had done this, Tom?
Yeah, the Thunder Mountain Big Band's played for that before a couple times, and exactly, you surprise the people coming off the airplane, especially if it's a big band.
It's not going to be such a big band. There's going to be a couple people playing.
Well, what I wanted to know from Tom is did anyone burst into song? I mean,
people start dancing.
With their suitcases.
As they waited for the luggage.
All right. Well, you were down in the baggage area down.
Right on the other side from it. Sometimes we only play it to the luggage.
That's right.
Is that where you're going to be?
I'll be down in the luggage claim area. Uh-huh. Yep.
So
just hanging out, playing some music.
Now, so are you going to put a case out with open with a donation to
accepted
here?
Yeah. I'm going to raise some scholarship money.
Yeah, okay. So. We should mention Kristen, when she doesn't have her Superman suit on with her violin in her hand, is also principal of Montessori, is that?
Principal of Montessori and Yakuza Dakigi Alternative High School and the Homebridge program.
Yeah, you've got busy days. How do you find the time to do all this stuff?
Well, you know, I decided to do Music on the Fly because I needed to make time to just do something for myself, and it was a good of a time as any. There was an opening, and it's like, yes, I'll take it. And also to just kind of publicize upcoming symphony concerts as well. I'm a member of the Juno Symphony, and we've got our big concert next weekend, farewell concert to Kyle.
Yeah.
And so the opportunity to remind people about that too.
So you're gonna be, you going toward pop or in your head, or are you going toward deep classical? Or are we gonna
deep classical?
Deep classical.
Deep
classical. Okay. Right. Okay. Good.
And one more contemporary
piece,
more like a fiddle tune.
Now we should mention here that this is not limited to passengers. If you want to hear some music, you just wander over to the airport. What time do you start?
I start 6:45.
Saturday, right?
Sunday evening.
Sunday evening, yeah, okay.
Sunday evening, 6:45.
And you're going to play, what, a couple hours?
I'll play about an hour.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, if you're in the vicinity and you want to wander by,
come
on down. Give her an audience here.
Yeah.
Bring a buck or two for the scholarship
there
money
you go.
As well.
Yep.
Yeah. So, Tom, what are you going to do tonight? What's the show look like?
We start at 5:30 and play till 7. And I think that the Thunder Mountain Big Band has had the routinely had the kickoff of the concert in the park season annually. So this is still part of their tradition to play the first summer gig at Concert in the Park, which is now renamed to, what is this called? What is the name of our...
Food Truck Friday.
Food Truck Friday.
Yeah,
that's a new term for me. I think it's the second one of the...
No, they did it last year.
They did it last year.
Yeah, they did.
We played at that.
The problem was that it was supposed to be Food Truck Friday. They won Food Truck. Because the trailers had not, the people had not gotten the equipment. But now we've got four or five working the streets. You know, we've been having these sunny days, which is a real strange thing for Juneau. And it's brought out the food trucks all of a sudden.
So it's going to work to have a sunny day, because if people don't want to be inside the Jack listening to the band, they're going to pipe the music, I understand, to the outside. So if people want to be outside enjoying their food out there in the sunny day and working on their tans, they'll still hear the music, which is important for the band.
But it's good you're doing that, because it's supposed to rain tomorrow. So Okay, but Sunday, you know, it doesn't matter if it rains. You come see Kristen over there.
And if you want to like pretend like you need to be there at the airport, you could just bring your luggage to the luggage claim area and just hang out with your luggage so you don't look
lost. Yeah, so you look like a passenger.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, not a bad idea. You could wear shorts and a Hawaiian shirt.
Sure, exactly. Lots of cameras.
Yeah, two or three cameras around your neck and so forth. Okay, is this, do we have the food guy here?
Jennifer Schlanger.
Okay, Jeff, can you kind of maybe get him a microphone somehow so that we can hear what we've got? So, let's see, this is Johnny Fishmonger, right?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so you're set up. Are you all set up now? Did you have time to get it all hooked up?
Oh, we're almost there.
Okay,
we just got back from the valley. We had to go get the oyster bar and the kazoos for the marching band.
Uh-huh.
Only in Alaska.
Only in Alaska. The kazoos for the marching band? You didn't tell me about kazoos.
I wasn't told about it.
You hadn't heard about kazoos.
So I can't tell you about it.
Okay. All right. Well, obviously you have diverse interests. So tell me about your food truck. Is it a truck?
No, just a booth.
You're under a booth. Okay.
There's only one truck on Pucker Wilson's Chad.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Best fries in Juneau.
Uh-huh. Oh, are they?
Love that guy.
Okay. What's your food specialty?
Sea Monster Seafoods.
Okay.
And my focus is to use as much local products as possible this whole summer on the Food Truck Fridays. I got a grant from the state to purchase from local farmers and local fruit growers under a USDA specialty crops grant. So it's real specific as to what you can buy. But I'm part of a challenge across the state this summer. It's 100% Locavore All-Alaskan Challenge, and I'm challenging a whole bunch of other chefs, mostly up north on the road system, but to see who can outdo each other on going full 100% on all the goods that they're serving at events and in their restaurants all summer long. And we're
going to
have a showdown up in Anchorage in like early October or something.
Can you get to there? You don't put lemon on side the fish now.
No, but lemon verbena. Grow me lemon verbena.
All right.
No, the hardest thing that to get was going to be some kind of cooking oil and pepper. So for the cooking oil, I don't have everything now. I'm probably at like almost 60-70% for this week. Uh-huh. And each week I'm going to be able to improve. And I should be at 100% by July, I think.
Are you cooking in fish oil or what?
I'm going to get goat cream or maybe butter from some farmers up in North Pole.
Oh, okay.
And then for pepper, I have people that are growing nasturtiums, and I'm going to smoke them in the smokehouse and then dry them and then grind them up, and that's going to be what I'm going to use for pepper.
All right.
And I think everything else we're going to do, not now, but we're slowly working it out with DNR and the state as far as all of our permitting and everything. We're going to have, and the foragers we're working with, so we'll have sea vegetables. We're going to have foraged beach greens, foraged forest greens, say that real quick three times.
Yeah.
And then we'll have some fungi, mushrooms, and that type of stuff. So, and sea salt from Sitka, and I'm probably going to make some of my own sea salt too.
Outstanding. Well, Thunder Mountain Big Band. I'm going to play. You guys start at 5:30.
Start at 5:30. Yeah. We're probably going to have about 20 charts that we're going to play.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could have just a moment to talk about them. Ron Maz is the leader of the band. He selects the charts. And we've got two sets of vocalists. We've got John Haywood, who's our Frank Sinatra, singing several charts. So that'll be from the Sinatra book. And then we have a trio, Miss Ain't Behavin'. And they're a boogie-woogie trio. They do the close harmony trio vocals like the Andrews sisters did. So it's going to be loaded full of vocals, too.
Yeah. Cool. Okay.
Very exciting.
Kristen, you're playing at the airport Sunday, 6:45, did you say?
Yep.
Yeah, 6:45. Violin player down in the baggage area, and you're going to be set up out there with the food truck. You are almost already set up, and folks can have some locavore food at your booth. That really sounds interesting to me.
I'm going to have takun sakai gravlax. It's last year's fish, but I made some gravlax out of it. And then I took some local rhubarb, and I made a pickled mignonette that I'm going to put on oysters, and the oysters are from Nakati on South Prince of Wales Island. And just real quick about the marching band, it's called March to the Munch. It's going to be every Friday at 4 o'clock starting at the Pavilion in Marine Park at the Pagoda there.
Uh-huh.
And I just went and rented a snare and a harness for a drummer, Alex from the Woolpoolers is going to be our drummers.
Yeah.
And we're going to, we're trying to do kind of like a, Pied Piper type of thing. So they're going to take off and go all the way down the boardwalk and then past the ships, then up Franklin and around downtown, and hopefully draw everybody out of their offices and get them to all come over to Food Truck Fridays and draw them over to all the other things that are happening over at the Jack every Friday, too.
Well, that explains the kazoo and mystery.
If you participate in the marching band, I promise to feed everybody a seafood and local greens dinner every time.
All right.
Everybody that does the marching band.
All right. Got to go play kazoo. Little music by Thunder Mountain Big Band. Go out here.
I swear I was falling. It's almost like being in love. It's almost like being in love.
As a
music is from Greece, and we're going to see Greece. Actually, we're going to get to sing Greece. That's an amazing thing that's going on at the Gold Town Cinema. Saturday, June 7th, right?
Yeah, tomorrow at 4:30.
Yeah, my guest here is going to tell us about this. Lay it on.
All right. So tomorrow at 4:30, we're going to have the Greece Sing-Along and Costume Contest. So come dress as your favorite Grease character. You have to be there a little bit before 4:30 to take part in the actual costume contest. And the movie will start immediately following the announcement of the winners. The grand prize was donated by Shoefly and Costco. I know at least part of the grand prize, which is with Shoefly, they have $25 gift certificates for their store. The tickets to get in are $8. They can be purchased in advance at Gold Town or on the day of.
And this benefits Reach.
Yes, this is being sponsored by Reach Inc.
Right. So it's in a really good cause, but you got to get a sense of how crazy this gets. You've got to go out on the website and search for one of these sites that's got the trailer on it.
Oh yeah, for the sing along.
Because it's people coming out of that theater and they're saying they feel like kids again. It's amazing how much fun people have at a thing like this.
Yeah, it's a perfect
the words are on the
movie
screen. So it's kind of like karaoke, right?
I'm not sure if they have the subtitled version or if they have just the regular version with singing encouraged.
Yeah, I know you've got the party kit, so I'm suspicious that maybe this has got the words right on the screen. I'm not sure which version it is. But anyway, it's a blast. Basically, mm-hmm. this one woman said, I won't be able to talk for 2 weeks. I sang every song. So it's a gas. It really is. So this is, let's see. Let's make sure we get times and everything. This is Saturday, mm-hmm. June 7th, mm-hmm. this Saturday, tomorrow, at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Yep.
Be there or be square, because this is Grease up on the screen, and you get to be the voice. That's the thing. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. Thanks for bringing this thing in, and thanks for making it possible for folks to do this sort of thing.
Thank you.
You bet. You're in tune with KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on a set of translators in the Valley in Auk Bay. We are on K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we are on K210 AS at 89.9. In Juneau, you can also get KTOO's signal on GCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard on digital channel 872. And KXLL can be found on digital channel 873. Monday at 3 on Juneau Afternoon, Joan Pardis will be hosting. She'll talk with Barbara Lavallee about her art. She's doing a book signing at Hearthside Books. Pianist Alexander Tudinoff will talk about his upcoming classes and concert, the Alaska Department of Fish and Games program, Alaskans Afield. They'll cover that. And we'll talk pollen with Teresa Nino from the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center of Alaska. So if you're sneezing, it'd be a great show to tune into. Stay tuned in just a few moments here for, you know, All Things Considered. Pat Moore, been your host. Thank you very much for listening.